Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What's most overwhelming about urban poverty that it's so difficult to escape. It's isolating, and yet it's everywhere. If you're an African-American child unlucky enough to be born in one of the poor neighborhoods of this nation, you are most likely to start life hungry or malnourished.
Barack Obama, from a major address he gave last week on his plans for America's cities. Tonight, CNN and YouTube will have an experimental debate among the Democratic presidential hopefuls with questions posted by many Americans via web video. We'll see if cities come up. We will preview the format of the debate in a few minutes and talk about some of the issues it raises, like why not have viewers also pick the questions, not editors at CNN. The technology for that does exist. But with me first to talk about the candidates is Washington Post editorial board member Jonathan Capehart, a New Yorker who used to be on the Daily News editorial board and who was also an advisor to Mayor Bloomberg at one point, who, by the way, Bloomberg is showing new signs of preparing for a run of his own, like going to the National Urban League conference in a swing state this week, Missouri. Jonathan Capehart, you may recall, has also been a guest host of this program. And Jonathan, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
Now, you've only been in D.C. a few months. Is it culture shock?
A little bit of culture shock, but only on really superficial things. It's actually quite nice down here.
Really? Because, you know, I'm curious, having never lived in D.C., to know if you find political culture at the national level in what is sort of, you know, a company town for the government to be very different from political culture in New York.
Yeah, political culture here is the culture of Washington, whereas in New York it's a little bit of politics, but a lot of fashion and business and finance and everything. So in New York you have a much bigger variety. Here, as someone advised me before I came down, they said, Jonathan, remember, in Washington, work is play, and play is work. And that is true.
And that is scary. Because if that's what our lawmakers think, and their play is the work that determines policy for our lives, well, maybe that is scary.
Well, I mean, if you have to look at it this way. I think it's no matter where you go, and especially if, I guess, you're on the national political scene, no matter where you go, you're going to run into people who you battle with on the Hill or who cover you from day to day. I mean, I've heard many stories of people who, you know, you're talking and they say, oh, yeah, his son and my daughter are in the same after-school program, or, yeah, his son and my son are on the same little league team.
Right. Although from what I hear, it's a lot less collegial than it was as, you know, Washington becomes more and more partisan. It's interesting to I can only wonder, I guess, how the Democrats and the Republicans with kids on the same little league team interact with each other, or maybe try to avoid the third baseline or whatever compared to a generation ago. So we played that clip from the urban policy address by Obama. I want to play another clip. This is from last Wednesday, and he specifically addresses something that's going on in New York, which is kind of very much the opposite of the John Edwards approach to fighting poverty. Edwards seems intent on trying to give poor people in urban areas the means to get out of the inner city with more housing vouchers rather than more money to housing projects, things like that. But here Barack Obama raises this example of something that he says is working in New York City for poor kids in place.
You'll find hope in 97 neighborhood blocks in the heart of Harlem, in New York City, in New York State. This is the home of the Harlem Children's Zone, an all-encompassing, all-hands-on-deck anti-poverty effort that is literally saving a generation of children in a neighborhood where they were never supposed to have a chance. The philosophy behind the project is simple. If poverty is a disease that infects an entire community in the form of unemployment and violence, failing schools and broken homes, then we can't just treat those symptoms in isolation. We have to heal the entire community.
Barack Obama from his urban policy address last Wednesday. Jonathan Capehart, how big a thing is this on the campaign trail, and why did he give an urban policy address now?
Well, I think the elementary answer to why he gave an urban policy address now is because John Edwards had just spent more than a few days on his own poverty tour, highlighting what's become the central issue for Edwards' campaign, and that is trying to shine a spotlight on poverty and what he calls the growing inequality gap, but what he calls, you know, the two Americas. It was a theme he employed when he ran for president in 2004. There was a little bit of it when he linked up with John Kerry when he was the vice presidential nominee, but now that he's running for president again, he's really pushing hard on it. And also, we have to point out that after he left the Senate and when they were unsuccessful in their run for the White House, he went back to North Carolina, set up an institute, I believe at the University of North Carolina, and made poverty the focus. So this is not new for John Edwards, but it is kind of new for Senator Obama, who for the most part and up until then hasn't really dealt with urban issues all that much.
Right. And I read an article in your paper, The Washington Post, that seemed to contrast their approaches. As I said before,
right,
Edwards focusing more on means of getting kids and families out of the inner cities, Barack Obama focusing more on helping people in place. Do you think
right.
that is, in fact, a substantial policy difference between them?
I'm sure that's a substantial policy difference. The ultimate goal being to help people in need, and people who are in need of jobs and health care, but also in need of hope. I think ultimately, you know, when it comes to fighting poverty, there is no one right answer or one right way to do it. And I think if Edwards is successful, or if Obama is successful in becoming president of the United States, or whoever the Democratic nominee, if that person becomes president of the United States and decides to take on poverty, they would do well to take a look at both the Edwards approach and the Obama approach. Because, you know, for Edwards, you know, having people get out of the inner cities, for some people, they might not want to do that. For Obama, helping people where they are, there might be people who want to say, you know, I don't want to be here anymore. So there could be, between these two plans, say the dreaded phrase, a third way.
And for listeners who are poor in New York or anyone else, what do you think of one approach versus the other approach, especially if you are poor in New York, poor in Newark, poor in Hartford, anywhere in our listening area? 212-433-WNYC. Should Democratic presidential candidates be focusing on ways to get you and your family out of an urban environment, or ways to make that urban environment work better for you in place? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Maybe you think this affects your kids, your grandkids, anyone. 212-433-9692 for Jonathan Capehart. Now, here's another political dynamic making news among the Democrats: Elizabeth Edwards taking on Hillary Clinton on women's issues.
I think that it's important when you are asking to be a leader who is addressing women's issues, that you, in fact, be that leader.
And so here we have the wife of a candidate saying that the actual woman in the race is not as good a leader on women's issues as her husband.
This is part of the larger story of Elizabeth Edwards as John Edwards' attack dog. This is the second time she has gone public with an attack or a criticism of someone who has attacked or criticized her husband. The first instance being the very dramatic phone call she made into the Hardball with Chris Matthews program on on MSNBC a couple of weeks ago, where she went up against Ann Coulter, who has said many nasty things about her husband and about Elizabeth Edwards and about their family.
Right, and they used that very successfully for fundraising letters that followed shortly thereafter. But it's one thing to go against Ann Coulter, a kind of cartoonish attack dog from the right. It's another thing for Elizabeth Edwards to accuse Hillary Clinton of not being a leader on women's issues.
Well, it struck me as odd, as it probably struck you as odd, and a lot of other people, because how do you say that the one woman in the race hasn't done anything on women's issues? It almost characterizing Senator Clinton as not being woman enough, in the same way that Barack Obama is being accused by some or labeled by some in the black community as not being black enough.
Do you know how specific Elizabeth Edwards has gotten on why she thinks John Edwards has a better record on women's issues than Hillary Clinton?
None come to mind at the moment.
She was just addressing the idea of leadership and letting people take it from there. Well, let's take a phone call. Marie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What
did
you want to say?
I wanted to address the issue of poverty in the inner city. Both my sister, my brother, and I were born and raised in Newark and educated there, and as soon as we could, we left. Mm-hmm. And my mom continues to live there, and she lives just above the poverty line, I would assume. She gets help from us, and she does own her property, but she will not leave Newark under any circumstances. And she lives in what I consider a police state. And we have a hard time grappling with the fact that she won't let us put her somewhere else. And her attitude is, you know, she sees someone like Cory Booker come in, and she keeps hoping for the best. And I just don't see it happening.
What do you mean by police state?
Well, and she lives in a place where, you know, you can't walk out at dusk. You know, I don't feel comfortable letting my mom walk to the store. You know, I don't feel comfortable having her drive around town because, you know, in a police state, in the context that I think the criminals have taken over the city.
So it worked for you to get out. And
yes.
I guess the question would be, you know, your mom, well, she's getting on and she's probably not going to want to change her ways. What about for the next generation of kids? What would be better, to try to make Newark a better place or to try to get them out of Newark?
I think I think you can't move everyone out of Newark, because for a while I lived in a suburb of Newark, and what was happening was you were transplanting the problem in Newark into places like Irvington and East Orange and the surrounding towns. So you have to fix the problem, not just displace individuals.
Marie, thank you for your call. I appreciate
thank
it
you.
A lot. Jonathan, to get back to the presidential candidates, we gave the full disclosure at the beginning that you used to work for Mayor Bloomberg, and you wrote a column. You wrote an op-ed piece for The Washington Post, where you're now an editorial board member, and you seem to be saying that Mayor Bloomberg is getting ready to run for president?
Well, I was saying that you have to... and also, full disclosure, Brian, this column was written in late June, so it was right after right after Mayor Bloomberg switched his party affiliation from Republican to unaffiliated or independent, if you will.
Right.
And a lot of people took that as yet another sign that he was going to run. I mean, personally, I think he wants to run. I think he wants to run, but I think he also doesn't want to do it if he's not going to win, much in the same way he went about running for mayor. You know, Kevin Sheehy has been quoted many times, and other people have been quoted as
his political aide, Kevin Sheehy, yeah.
Right, deputy mayor, has been quoted as saying that he would spend maybe $500 million. You know, $500 million to a multi-billionaire, it's not a big deal, but you don't want to spend $500 million or maybe even $1 billion running for president just 'cause. If you're going to do it, you're going to get in it to win it. And the only way I think he'll be able to do it is not until maybe March or April, where we all know who the Democratic nominee is and who the Republican nominee is, and then judging the mood of the nation. And I think we'll know who those nominees are by about February 5th, because it seems like every state in the nation has now moved up its primary to February 5th to create this not even Super Tuesday, a Mega Tuesday.
Let's take another call. Paul in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Good. I'm a pastor in the Bronx here, and many of my parishioners are in poverty. And if it were actually a policy recommendation to move people out of the city, that would just be, you know, disastrous for the cities themselves. The South Bronx, when it was burning, there was actually relatively low population, and I would be shocked if that was really John Edwards' plan, is to try to get people to move out.
Right. Well, he wants to give them the means to move out by expanding, and we're going to talk about this more on tomorrow's show when we look closely at the New York City Public Housing Authority, but he wants to break up the concentrations of urban poverty, or at least give individual families the opportunity to leave for themselves, focusing more of his housing aid on vouchers that allow people to go and live anywhere than on housing subsidies like public housing in place. Paul, with your experience in the Bronx, does that make sense to you? Do you think your parishioners would jump at that opportunity?
The more entrepreneurial ones might. What would happen if you'd leave sort of the most destitute and problematic cases in the Bronx, which would, you know, be really bad. When Jerusalem was overtaken back in the old days, in the biblical days, all the talent left and left a disaster. So I mean, we need the talent and the you know, bright people
right.
to stay in the city.
So you're really saying that might be desirable to the individuals who would take advantage of it, but it would actually be worse for the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Paul, thank you very much. Jonathan Capehart, any reaction to that before
we take
a break and then preview this YouTube debate tonight?
Sure. I think both Paul and Marie hit on two very important issues here. On the one hand, you want folks who want to be able to get out of urban environments and urban situations, you want them to be able to do it. On the other hand, by doing that, you run the risk of hollowing out a city, if you will, and leaving those behind who can't, for one reason or another, leave the inner city, leave poverty behind. And that's why I think ultimately you will need to have a combination of Edwards and Obama's visions to really get at the problem of poverty in the inner cities. Allow folks who want to move someplace better, allow them to do that, give them the means to do that. But for those who want to stay because, you know, those places are their homes, beef up services and access to opportunity in those areas so that they can live a fulfilled life.
Jonathan Capehart, editorial board member of the Washington Post, former Daily News editorial board member, former Mayor Bloomberg advisor, former guest host of this program before he abandoned us to head south for D.C. and the Washington Post. And we'll continue with Jonathan in a minute. We will also add Mika Sifri from the website Tech President as we preview tonight's YouTube CNN Democratic presidential debate experience. And by the way, we'll be airing that debate at 9 o'clock on AM 820 tonight.
While we can't stop every job from moving overseas, we can stop giving tax breaks to companies who send them there and start giving them to companies who create jobs here in the United States of America. That's something that we can do right away.
Barack Obama, again from his urban policy speech delivered last Wednesday. And now to the CNN YouTube debate experiment tonight, which will, of course, include Barack Obama as well as all the other Democratic presidential hopefuls, with questions coming from regular Americans via web video. Jonathan Capehart from the Washington Post editorial board is still with us, and also with us now, Mika Sifri, executive editor of the Personal Democracy Forum and editor of the website Tech President, which follows the effect of technology on the presidential race. Mika, welcome back to WNYC.
Always good to be here, Brian.
So are you excited about this debate tonight? Is it more than a gimmick?
Yeah, it's definitely more than a gimmick. It's going to be interesting to see which videos folks at CNN decide to pose to the candidates, and given that it'll be questions coming directly from quote-unquote real people, that's a change. We think this is a good first step towards really democratizing the process in the ways that the Internet makes possible, but frankly, I'm not all that excited. It's just a Democratic debate. These things often aren't that interesting, generically. And, you know, we think they could do a whole lot more to involve the audience in the process than they're currently doing.
Are you on one side or another of this debate about whether users of YouTube should be able to vote on the questions rather than having the journalism professionals at CNN pick the questions out of the submissions for actual use?
Yeah, we think, and we've been editorializing about this, that CNN ought to allow the users, the community, if you will, at YouTube to have a much bigger part in this process. They keep saying, well, if we do that, then the top viewed video question right now is one that asks whether Arnold Schwarzenegger is actually a cyborg.
Is that true?
That is, according to YouTube, the top viewed video. But we've been working closely with a website called communitycounts.us, which was started by a high school teacher who happens to be a YouTube user named David Colarusso. And he and a bunch of other people thought it would be great if the community would vote on which videos they think are most worth discussing, and hopefully the candidates will answer these. And that's developing a very different list of what the top choices are. The first one there is about whether Bush should be impeached. The next one there is a question about health care. They're serious questions, and I think CNN is being a little bit unfair when they say, we know best, and, you know, we shouldn't let the community have a bigger part of that process.
All right. Our community, you can vote on this question now. And as I always say, when we open up the phones, an informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific poll on whether you would like YouTube users to be able to vote on which of the questions actually get asked to the presidential candidates, or after making their question submissions, whether the editors at CNN, which is airing this debate, should get to choose. Which would serve you better as a prospective Democratic primary voter in this CNN-YouTube debate? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or anything else you want to say or ask of Mika Sifri, editor of the website Tech President, and Jonathan Capehart, member of the editorial board of The Washington Post. And I should mention something in conjunction with this. If you watch or listen to the CNN YouTube debate, you can comment on it live or afterwards on our website with our first ever WNYC debate scorecard.
That's great.
And you can find it tonight at WNYC.org. We will ask who won the debate for you and why, who made you think about an issue in a new way, what was the most memorable response, and you can grade CNN on how they handled the YouTube questions. So you can do that tonight in real time during the debate on our website or post afterwards on our first ever WNYC debate scorecard at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show. And by the way, I'll call this debate scorecard 1.0, and we'll try to develop this for future debates, and maybe we'll get an actual numerical scoring thing going that might be kind of fun but really issue-oriented also. But for tonight, it'll be really very tabula rasa for your first-ever WNYC online debate scorecard, which will start being available later in the day. And the debate airs live on CNN at 7 o'clock. And we will air it on AM 820 in toto beginning at 9 o'clock. So just all of that housekeeping for what's coming up tonight here around this debate. Mika, you seem to like that idea.
Well, you know, I love the idea because what you're doing is that you're closing the feedback loop. What CNN is doing is they're going to produce interesting television tonight. The questions will undoubtedly be from some unexpected places. There have been some questions submitted by people in Darfur, for example, and there's bound to be a more emotional kind of impact to hearing a question directly from someone who's affected rather than by, you know, just from a professional journalist asking the question. But what we'd like to see is the rest of that feedback loop. I think that CNN is missing a big opportunity to involve the audience in also helping judge whether the candidates answer the question and whether you're satisfied with the answer. I mean, the problem with debates today, as they've become these big broadcast television events, is that they're mostly for show. The candidates don't really answer the questions. They sort of say, yes, that was a good question, and then pivot to whatever their talking points are.
Jonathan Capehart, as a professional journalist, what do you think about this?
Well, on your most immediate point, Mika, I think one of the reasons why these debates have become just shows because there are about 10 candidates per debate in each session, and you only have, 90 minutes or sometimes 2 hours to cover, basically to cover the world, and everybody only has about a minute. What I would love to see are issues debates where you have, for 90 minutes or 2 hours, a candidate having to answer questions on one issue. And so, like healthcare,
sure,
or law enforcement, anything that gets them away from their comfort zones. But on the larger issue, you know, I do think, especially since this is the first time that YouTube has been involved in the presidential process, in the presidential debate process, that you do need to have some kind of what I would call adult supervision of some sort to make sure that real issues and questions get asked, whether that's CNN, whether that's someone who is keeping check to make sure that, you know, the big question that comes from the community is Governor Schwarzenegger a cyborg?
Well, I think what we're seeing from a site like Community Counts is that you can trust the crowd, that the people who are engaged in asking these questions and then filtering the best ones upward are doing a good job of filtering for serious questions. And, you know, as far as adult supervision, a lot of us have seen how the media, the professional media, can fall down on its job when it should be asking tough questions. I think seared in my mind is the behavior of all those professional journalists at that news conference that President Bush had on the eve of the Iraq War, when they all seem to be trembling in their boots. So I think, yes, you're right, we should make sure the questions are serious. I don't think that the only way of doing that is the way that CNN has chosen. That said, it's great that they're trying this. It's a step into the future. I think the David Borman, who is the vice president of CNN, was quoted in the Times today as saying he doesn't want to mess this up, because he wants to be sure that the candidates will agree to participate in debates like this in the future. And so I think we can all agree, let's see how this goes as an experiment. I just think from YouTube side of this that there's so much more that YouTube could be doing. Just think about this fact. On the web, there's no time limit. There's nothing that says you have to stop the debate at 90 minutes or 2 hours if you're holding it on the web. We could have a much longer, richer debate about all the issues on the web, and, you know, TV could just be the tip of the pyramid.
Let's take some phone calls. Jim in Union City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have a problem with I agree that the debates are just a show. I understood Hillary's rejecting the raising of hands, but maybe they should just, if there's going to be such a large number of people, they could have them billed as a grand jury and have them say yes, no, or if there is a more nuanced answer, to allow that person to speak. But having a more popular source for the questioning doesn't improve the quality of the questioning. We saw even back with Dukakis being questioned by Shore as to whether or not, it was a complete hypothetical. We knew that Dukakis was against the death penalty, but it was just ridiculous. And even though it was the undoing of Dukakis, aside from his wearing the helmet in the tank, it really doesn't get to the point of the issue.
So you think ordinary people and professional journalists are kind of at equal risk of asking dumb questions?
Yes.
Jim, thank you. Jean in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I think we're not really zeroing in on why CNN is doing the edit the way they're doing it. I think your guest mentioned earlier that when you crib the questions from another, you know, from the other end, that you get a very different picture of what's really on people's minds and what they're most concerned about and want to, you know, ask questions about. Whereas CNN, I think, is trying to screen out the toughest questions.
That's pretty conspiratorial. Why would they try to do that?
Because if you look at the media in general, it's very clear to me, at least, that there is an avoidance, that the media do not want certain kinds of things really to be in the public debate.
Give me one.
There are certain aspects, for example, of the war in Iraq that nobody wants to seems to want to be openly discussed.
We want to hear it. I want to know.
Yeah, the fact that one of the largest military bases in the world that the U.S. has ever constructed is being built in Iraq and has been under construction from day one of the invasion. So with all of this talk about exit strategy, you know, when we're going to get out. There's no plan for the United States to get out of Iraq. It is intending to have a very permanent presence there.
That is a great question for the candidates. What about permanent presence, which is being talked about outside the mainstream political circles as more of a salient issue? So thanks for getting to that good example, Gene. Jonathan Capehart, you know, the funny thing is that despite Gene's concern that CNN tries to edit out the hardest questions, which I don't think they would, you know, try to do consciously,
right,
that the opposite concern often gets expressed, which is that they're most concerned with the gotcha questions, the professional, you know, debate script writers, mm-hmm. so that they're focusing and trying to put a candidate in a difficult position about their past record versus their current statements or whatever it is, but that those aren't necessarily the things that inform the citizens the most about who's going to make the best next leader.
Right. I think the gotcha question has been a little overused, and that's why I say you have a tendency to have more of those types of questions when you have 10 people on a stage, 90 minutes, and you're trying to cover a ton of subjects in that time. Whereas if you had specific issue-oriented debates, the gotcha question becomes a cheap shot question, and the audience will boo or hiss or whatever, because what they want, they came to hear, what's your plan, Senator Edwards, for health care? What's your plan, Senator Obama, mm-hmm. for poverty? What's your plan, Senator Clinton, for you know, ending the war in Iraq?
And you know what I am curious about, Mika? Are the CNN, I guess Anderson Cooper is the host of this tonight, is he going to be able to ask follow-up questions? Because it's one thing to have an authentic question from somebody who's not a beltway. And we heard from Jonathan earlier how, you know, everybody's kids play Little League with each other, so in D.C. So it's good to have, you know, non-beltway Americans asking these questions, but you also need tough journalistic informed follow-up.
Yeah, no, and I'm sure Anderson is going to ask follow-up questions. I mean, they've made clear that he is the sort of the vehicle through which these questions are going to flow. It sounds to me like they're lining up a couple of dozen clips that they'll have ready, and for all you know, he'll use a second, you know, as a follow-up, he'll pull up another clip and say, you know, so-and-so from whatever has a good follow-up to that point. I suspect that they've got actually a pretty good show in plan for us, and it'll make the whole thing a little more interesting to watch.
Let me take one more caller who has a suggestion for how a future such debate might be structured using journalists' expertise and citizen populism. Alan in Brooklyn?
Yes, thank you for putting me on. Basically, either party could decide on one or two, some number of things that the other has brought up, like those that bubble up through YouTube, picks 200, or CNN as professional journalists picks 200 and lets YouTube then pick amongst them.
So the thousands of submissions might come in. The editors at CNN might pick the 200 that they think are most usable in a real debate, and then the YouTube YouTube users could vote on which of those to push to
sure.
the very top of the list.
Sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. And Mike, again, we're almost out of time, mm-hmm. but the idea here is some kind of what Jay Rosen from NYU calls pro-am journalism, right? Professional amateur coalition.
Exactly. And I think CNN would be very wise to move in that direction, because the community, what we're seeing is thousands of people actually have serious questions they want to ask, and they're filtering them already. And, you know, this is work that poor old Dave Borman is doing by himself in a bus right now, trying to figure out which questions are worth asking. Involve the community, and I think the Internet is driving us in that direction. We're going to see this happen more and more with politics.
Jonathan Capehart, Washington Post editorial board member, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks, Brian.
And Mika Sifri, editor of Tech President. Is that techpresident.com?
That's right.
And I know you have a lot to say about this at your website, so we'll be watching. Thank you very much.
Good to be here, Brian.
And again, for all of you, if you watch or listen to the CNN YouTube debate, you can comment on it live or afterwards on our website with our first ever WNYC debate scorecard. You can find it tonight at WNYC.org. We'll talk about it tomorrow morning. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, why the farm bill might make you fat. Stay tuned.